Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. I'm Alex Linder and today we are going to do The Feminization of American Culture by Anne Douglas, a book written by a feminist, but a serious intellectual feminist back in the 70s. The point of this book in your white education is to explain to you how America came to be so anti-intellectual, favoring the sentimental, the untrue, and the superficial over the deep and the factual. We're going to pick it up where we left off on page 155, and we're going to go subtitle by subtitle, unless there's a really short one, because the chapters are extremely long. It's a 400-page book, and the chapters would be like, 50, 80 pages, so we need to divide it up a little bit. Conversion and church membership from testing to playing. Remember, the context here is that the first whites who came to America, the British colonizers, were generally led by preachers. And these were hardy, tough, rugged men. They were real leaders, not just spiritual leaders, but they were the larger, tougher, mentally sharper men in the community. But over time, that type of man tended to go into business and building up the country once it became a little bit larger population-wise, and a different type of man moved into the preachership or the preaching. And this was perceived by people at the time, so the institution of the church became inherently more feminized. It served more of a female, passive type of audience, more given to influencing than directly acting. And catering to the women became an important part of the minister's job. Also, we've heard in earlier chapters how the church was disestablished, so that it had no guaranteed means of support. Well, when you don't have a means of support, then that means the market. And when you have a market, you have to serve the customer. And in the case of something like spiritual guidance, the customer might like to hear something that isn't what he needs to hear. Like my dad always used to say, I don't know what you want, but I know what you need. And I'm sure he got that from somewhere else, but it lingers in my mind. It's one of his favorite sayings. But the point here is, if I'm dependent upon you for my income, then I have an incentive not to tell you what you need to hear, but to tell you what you want to hear, whatever feels good. And there's a whole huge self-help industry built on feeding people what they want to hear about themselves. That you can't love anyone else until you love yourself. But loving oneself is not really a problem with any of us. We all know ourselves better than anyone else, and we feel our own pains more intensely than anyone else's, we might say. So it's what we need to hear, and that's got to come from someone who's, let's say, disinterested, because otherwise we have to rely on his character to tell us what we need to hear, even though it's against his own personal interest. And while some might be willing to do that, you can't push that too far and expect people. You can't expect the heroic. So you need to have things that are kind of outside of the market, like your parents are outside of the market. You don't go and buy new parents. They're going to tell you what you need to hear, and you can't simply displace them. Well, so it has to be more or less with the spiritual parents, which would be the teachers. Some would say the state, but the state's pretty poorly suited for that kind of thing, because it's after its own interest. And the fact that it has no incentive to serve people is not good in that instance. But anyway, the removal of official state support, even though the ministers supported that themselves, would have different effects, but one of the effects would be that it would tend to produce someone who's going to more cater to the desires of the flock. And like I say, in most market situations, that's good. The businessman is serving his customer, but in this unique case, the person may know in a more general sense what he needs, but what he wants is something different. All the things that you like to eat are bad for you. The things you need to eat don't taste so great a lot of times. So it's like that spiritually and character-wise. it does come back to character, doesn't it? But nevertheless, market incentives or actual professional incentives are important to consider too. So this is where we pick it up. Conversion and church membership from texting to playing, or testing to playing. No, texting. There was no texting back in 77. The personalized, feminized, literary Bushnellian view of the atonement was, as we have seen, a non-crisis-oriented one, And it implied and presupposed. So naturally, their conceptions of Jesus change, and Jesus becomes the all meek, the all, you know, loving and tolerant and mercy. And all this is at the expense of the masculine judiciousness or judgment. Jesus as the fighter, as the judger, as the law promulgator, you see, or the fulfillment of the law versus the merciful, loving side. That's all you hear emphasized today. The personalized, feminized, literary, Bushnellian view of the atonement was, as we have seen, a non-crisis-oriented one, and it implied and presupposed a tranquil theory of religious development in man as well as in God. In the older Calvinist scheme, some persons were saved, others were not, and the difference was a momentous and hopefully visible one. So the thinking is they would strive to prove by means of material success that they were among the tiny minority chosen by God, the elect, and their visible worldly success would be the proof of that. And this is how that group does tend to think. It's part of the reason they worship money so much. Or you see the love of God or respect for God shades into the worship of money. That's how that happens. God's ways were both unknowable and exact. Momentously, one person was taken, another was left, although the why of it might not be clear. There was an immense incentive for thought-filled precision in this creed with its imperious and legalistic atonement. Gary North would be the foremost exemplar of this school of thought today, I believe, the guy who writes for Lou Rockwell. He was in the Y2K fraud, but nevertheless, he has a lot of intelligent things to say. And if you follow him, he will write about all the people who are really concerned with Calvinism. He is like a modern Calvinism of the old school, I think he would call himself. I don't know what precisely he would call himself, but that's what it amounts to. So I just give these as part of your education. I can give you suggestions to other paths. It's not like I know everything or even a tiny thimble full of everything. There's much, 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 much more to be known than any one person can know. But what I can do is point you in the right direction. And if you're Catholic, that'd be Michael Jones. If you're, you know, Protestant in some direction, take a look at Rush Dooney. Take a look at Gary. Gary North mentions Rush Dooney. That's where I heard about him. So, repressive as it was, Calvinism was empirical, even scientific, in the special objectivity it fostered and demanded in its most faithful believers. If God had few soft spots in his heart, little sympathy for man, remember sinners in the hands of an angry God, the good minister owed it to his flock to be equally harsh, equally factual, and equally determinate. Now see, these were people like me who basically enjoy speaking what they take to be the plain truth straight out, and kind of a not out of wanting to hurt or hate anyone or even support and help them, but just out of the simple feeling of getting it right. This is what's actually going on, and not the glory that VNN was founded in, and this is something not founded in, is the masculine speed and purity that cannot survive or barely survive the female nesting impulse. So when it's separated from that, all you get from me is straight, here's what I believe is actually going on. Am I right about it? Of course I'm not right about everything. And part of the instruction from any serious instructor is not to tell you what to think. Just to indicate, here's what someone who's smart, honest, and has studied the matter has concluded about it, but still I can separate that from the objective facts. And if I can't, then you must be able to. You must be able to outthink me or think, what is he not telling me, or what is he missing here that would flesh this out further? Because it's always incomplete. It's just coming away with more than you started with. Must be the goal of intellectual development, right? Show you ways of thinking or mental approaches, mental techniques, as well as specific facts and bits of history that are relevant to today and how we got here. So the only antidote for divine wrath at a clergyman's disposal was ministerial wrath. The only immunity to punishment was in its anticipation. Calvinism could give to those who believed it a confidence, which at times merged unpleasantly with arrogance, that they were at least fully armed, if not invulnerable. The greatest figures of New England Calvinism showed an ability to examine and judge religious states, which was to become legendary. Samuel Hopkins was noted for the kindly meant cruelty with which he discouraged even dying parishioners who he believed to be entertaining a, quote, false hope. This is great. These are the original. I'm descended from some of them. These are the original assholes who show up the bedside like, I know you're sick and you're dying and I'm here to make your misery even worse. You're not going to heaven. You're going to hell. You came damn close, kid. You really gave it the college try, but yeah, came up short. Sorry. Better luck next time. I mean, they really were real assholes. And I like to think a little of that spirit survives in VNN. But anyway, oh, this is so funny. So you see how these people, they've always been known by the Southerners, the Cavaliers, like these people are incredibly mutable. These Northeastern Protestants, they come up with 100 reform movements, 99 of which are zany, crazy things. It's still funny, though, to track it. He says, so Samuel Hopkins, he discouraged even a dying parishioner who he believed to be entertaining a false hope, because they were all about reality. See, they wouldn't be buying bullshit like diversity is your greatest strength. They'd be dealing with the reality of it. In 1755, called to the deathbed of a woman, quote, full of joy and comfort, supposing she had had saving discoveries of Christ, unquote, he was satisfied, quote, upon examining her, that she was deceived, that it was only the workings of her imagination. She was confident, but I told her my fears. I mean, you got to appreciate it. This is all completely delusional. It's all in the heads of these people that any of this exists, but they believe it wholeheartedly, as best we can tell. With resigned insight, he concludes, how exposed to the delusions of the devil are ignorant persons, especially those whose understanding is shattered and their imagination lively by a fever. So these people are literally on their deathbed. They're feverish and they're hallucinating that Jesus is going to save them, but the priest shows up to disabuse them of that silly notion. That's how these Christians used to be, these hardcore Calvinist types. And they were, needless to say, a much better type then than they are now, where they're all Joel Osteen grinning. Can you imagine him showing up at someone's deathbed and telling them anything other than exactly what they wanted to hear? Drawing back his lying lips to reveal his overly white teeth. This is not something good or wholesome, even apart from the basic Christian delusion. You know what I'm saying. Nathaniel Emmons brought the same relentless spirit of investigation to the consideration of his son Erastus, is a good old school name, who died in 1820. He had found little that was promising there, and with the more than Roman rigor, the spare severity which ever characterized him, he told his congregation so in the funeral sermon he preached on the occasion. Block quote here. Now this is a guy speaking about his own son. He lived stupid, thoughtless, and secure in sin until he was brought to the very sight of death. But whether he did ever heartily renounce the world and choose God for his supreme portion cannot be known in this world. In his own view, he had become reconciled to God, but it is more than possible that, like others on the sickbed, he built his hopes upon a sandy foundation. So these guys are so hardcore, they're not even willing to think that their own kids are going to heaven, or rigorous. You can see how this would parallel with intellectual rigor in other areas. They're going to be honest. They're not going to buy the cheap lies, brummagem lies, right? And we can admire that, right? Of course. Emmons, like most of his persuasion, expected the Lord's workings in the human soul to be marked and momentous. No easy assurances of inner peace, whether given on a deathbed or elsewhere, could satisfy him. Throughout the 19th century, the more theologically conservative and revivalistically oriented denominations kept the earlier Calvinist emphasis on a pronounced, even violent, often sudden conversion experience. Revivals themselves were, of course, premised on the reality of such an experience. Lyman Beecher's attitude, again, we get into the abolitionist types, Lyman Beecher's attitude toward conversion was typically evangelical. His own religious awakening, as he remembered it in later years, was quick and powerful, possessing obvious and conscious parallels to Paul's epiphany on the road to Damascus. That's a Damascene conversion when he changed from Saul to Paul. At the age of 20, Beecher was deeply struck by a remark of his mother's on a passing drunkard who had once been, quote, under conviction, unquote, but had since lost all religious inclinations. Block quote here. There was no perceptible effect from these words, only after she left the room, I felt a sudden impulse to pray. I was not in the habit of prayer. I rose to pray, and had not spoken five words before I was under as deep a conviction as I ever was in my life. The sinking of the shaft was instantaneous. I understood the law, and my heart as well as I do now, or shall in the day of judgment. I believe the commandment came, sin revived, and I died, quick as a flash of lightning. Beecher remained faithful throughout his career to his own conversion experience as a model. That is something really powerful, and she keeps using the word momentous, of great weight and prominence, significance. In 1829, he wrote a friend testifying to his belief in instantaneous, in quotes, as opposed to, quote, gradual conversion, and he was always willing to analyze and defend the conviction he had thus received. Beecher's awakening was implicitly a testimony to God's power, as well as to Beecher's own importance, a tribute to divine ability to intervene massively and decisively at a given instance in an individual's life. Beecher's most famous children belonged to a very different generation theologically, and none of them were able or willing to achieve a similar experience. From the start, Beecher urged his sons and daughters to agonize, to enter in at the strait gate. Certainly he himself agonized over them and regularly subjected their hearts to a scrutiny almost as piercing as Emmons. Beecher's happiness in his revival work was deeply alloyed by the realization that none of his own family were, quote, safe. See, they're all thinking and hoping that they're chosen, but knowing that it's a very small minority that actually is, and most of them must despair ultimately and go to hell. Imagine believing such a thing. Edward stalled almost endlessly and never knew a full saving experience. Catherine was unable to undergo conversion at all, despite a barrage of letters written to her and published by her father in the 1820s. Harriet defied most of the rules of Edwardsian theology by Jonathan Edwards, that is, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. Harriet defied most of the rules of Edwardsian theology by coming into her father's study at a very tender age, full of happy confidence that the Lord had simply taken her to be his own. She felt no anguish, only infinite calm and joy. Henry Ward, Beecher, again, as a boy, was puzzled and troubled by the whole process, pressured constantly by demands he could neither meet nor dispute. This is the thing, you're dealing with something that's insubstantial, that's all in your head, you can't even get people on the same page in terms of understanding what is being talked about, because it's essentially it's mental activity and delusional. But nevertheless, it can be understood or believed in different degrees, and it can have some effect on behavior, whether good or bad. But you know me, I don't believe in delusion as a basis of social order I believe it's better to be undiluted. And then they will say, oh, you're under delusions, you just don't recognize them. Well, I'm not under your delusions, is how I conjoin that stupidity with something better that will smother it. Significantly, the Beecher children, with the possible exception of Catherine, did not want their father as the engineer of their conversion or the intercessor of the throne. They longed to see their mother, rather, Roxanna Foote Beecher, in that role. Henry Ward, explaining his childhood religious perplexity, wrote significantly, quote, I wanted to be a Christian. I went about longing for God as a lamb bleating longs for its mother's udder. Henry Ward was barely three when his mother died of consumption in 1816. But even then, according to family legend, he made an effort to run away to Ma in heaven, and he talked of her his whole life. Harriet, in explaining her mother's role in family life, later wrote that, quote, her memory and example had more influence in molding her family, in deterring from evil and exciting to good, than the living presence of many mothers. She represented for her children a blessed figure, a, quote, saint in heaven. Harriet recalled vividly waking from a virulent, nearly fatal fever as a child to hear her father praying thankfully to his dear wife, now with the Lord. As Harriet paints the scene, there was a clear sense that Roxana Beecher has saved her daughter by her holy mediation, just as she stood, quote, as a sacred shield, unquote, between her sons and the temptations of youth, end quotes. It is worth remembering that Charles Beecher, Roxana's youngest born, Charles Beecher, Roxana's youngest born, dedicated his Bushnellian work on the Atonement, the Redeemer and the Redeemed, to his mother, whom, as he said, next to his Savior, he most hoped to meet at the resurrection. Roxana Beecher has both special and representative significance. By all accounts, an extraordinarily gifted and intelligent woman, reserved, quiet, evincing fine breeding and even elegant manners, with artistic taste and a keen interest in science, she came from an Episcopalian family and never essentially changed her faith. Episcopalian would be about the highest, high-end Protestant. A lot of presidents are Episcopalians, the opposite of, say, Southern Baptist, or Baptist generally. Indeed, in the early days of their courtship and marriage, Lyman, fresh from his theological training and preparing for his first ministerial assignment on Long Island, kept trying to test, a la Hopkins or Emmons, the soundness of his fiancée's religious hope. He was essentially anxious because she confessed to none of the negative aspects of the traditional conversion experience. She did not acknowledge, quote, a disposition so horrid as even to curse God to his face, unquote, such as Bellamy had posited. We've heard about him in earlier chapters. She did not seem to love God's glory, quote, disinterestedly, that is, without respect to her personal interest. Not uninterested means you don't care. Disinterested means you don't have a direct personal interest, like whether or not she would go to heaven would make her interested. Not in the sense of caring, but in the sense of objectively interested in God and his disposition. But the goal would be to love God disinterestedly, regardless of what his plans for you, just because you should. She did not seem to love God's glory disinterestedly, without reference to the good he had done her. So, yeah, you love God because God is good for you, which is not how it's supposed to be. Roxana Summerer, he was afraid of that, her husband Lyman. This is the sort of thing, apparently, at least those on the higher end took very seriously back before the current times. Roxana summarized her belief and her opposition to her future husband in a letter written on September 1st, 1798, which was to become in many ways a key document of her children's experience and to serve as the base of their own Declaration of Independence. Drawing on her Episcopalian and her feminine heritage, she dismisses a non-human God by the simple evidence of her own feelings. Block quote from Roxana Beecher. How can I help loving God because he is good to me? Were I not an object of God's mercy and goodness, I cannot have any conception what would be my feelings. Imagination never yet placed me in a situation not to experience the goodness of God in some way or other, and if I do love him, how can it be but because he is good, and to me good? Do not God's children love him because he first loved them? In contemplating the character of God, his mercy and goodness are most present to my mind, and, as it were, swallow up his other attributes. So these are basically very intelligent people who are arguing. This is what I thought and argued about back then. It doesn't even matter almost if it's true or not. Of course it does. But the fact that they worked their minds to a very great, almost irritating degree in order to prove different, and you get their shades of their disagreement. I mean, after all, who can say? There are texts you can refer to, but the text can easily be turned a thousand ways, as Shakespeare says. We always like to quote, the devil can cite scripture for his purpose. Anyone can, they can take pleasure in outwitting each other, proving that they're right. If they can't prove it intellectually, then they prove it, I have more material asset. That proves God chose me over the other little people. There's no water in our lettuce. All right, almost 60 years later, her husband touchingly and characteristically endorsed this letter, quote, Roxana beloved still this December 5th, 1854, Lyman Beecher. There is little evidence to show that Roxana's epistle changed his thinking, however, although his children sometimes like to think so. Roxana Foote, anticipating Ballou and Bushnell and her stress on the primacy of God's love, on the deity's intent to win her by giving her what she needs and wants, is obviating the necessity of a painful and sudden conversion experience. There is nothing disagreeable or difficult for her to contemplate, only God's love. So there's no, there with the drama left out. There's nothing disagreeable or difficult or new for her to do. God had been continuously sustaining her by his affection and gradually bringing her closer and closer to him. The religious awakening, Beecher advocated, was a violent and immediate one, essentially because it assumed the confrontation of two enemies, God's grace and man's sinful nature, and the absolute conquest of the latter by the former. That is, in a flash, the man is awakened to his truly, thoroughly sinful, corrupt nature and is won over to the God side to obey his commandments and overcome that nature to the limited extent he can. And they want that to be a dramatic, like a like the heavy part of, say, like a Creed song, you know, would capture that conversion, lightning striking, you know. God's grace in man's sinful nature and the absolute conquest of the sinful nature by God's grace. Man is being assimilated into something not like him, hyphenated. Violation as well as regeneration is at work. Roxana's implied view of conversion, which was to be Bushnell's, is not that a battle between two antagonists, but an evolving mutual assimilation of two similar, if unequal, beings. It's a much milder, more feminine view. There's no conflict there. Edward, Henry, and Charles all concluded by adopting Roxana's view while officially staying within their father's church, despite repeated protests and efforts at expulsion on the part of that often bewildered and antagonized church. Harriet and Catherine espoused their mother's testimony and her denomination. More and more religious thinkers and activists of the generation succeeding Lyman Beecher's sidestepped or redefined the traditional conversion experience. Even Edward J. Park, who would show revivalist proclivities and a decided admiration for Finney, at 18 decided to become a minister, although he had experienced no special religious awakening. He tested himself and felt that he had not only believed but loved the biblical doctrines, and that was sufficient, that this was sufficient. Austin Phelps passed a sensitive, not to say morbid, boyhood in the grip of religious despair. End quotes. His father, a rather stern congregational minister, forced the boy, for his moral edification, to attend funerals and look at the corpses. This is how people were back then. And there were a lot more corpses because they didn't have modern medicine. They died earlier. At 12, he was almost converted in the traditional Calvinist way. He, quote, longed for and waited for some sublime and revolutionary change of heart, unquote. In later years, he found his earlier agonies pathetic and totally unnecessary. He adopted a Bushnellian belief in religious, quote, nurture, unquote, and, quote, unconscious growth based on a domestic model. Quote, the family is the nursery of faith, and the church is but the family on an extended scale, unquote. Phelps even speculated that he might have been far happier had he been raised an Episcopalian. Orville Dewey, also reared a Calvinist, repudiated his early training with equal vehemence. He came to feel that, quote, infidelity, unquote, was more defensible than Calvinism. Dewey found his youthful conversion regrettable. Quote, it is lamentable that it should ever be an event in any human life, unquote. It is significant that both Phelps and Dewey intensely protested the way their Orthodox parents had treated them as children. The Calvinist child went to church with his or her family twice on Sunday to sit in a pew, often so constructed that few adults, and certainly no children, could see out of it, and to listen to long, detailed, and often highly abstract sermons written by adults for adults. Can you imagine that today? Perhaps he or she was allowed to play with the strings of mother's purse, to look through the prayer book, or at best to eat some treat specially brought along to reward or pacify younger members of the family. They're sitting in pews so deep they can't even see out of them, listening to abstract sermons for hours, twice on a Sunday. Even little kids. That's how intellectually serious they were back then compared to today. The child, as such, was an often uncomfortable hostage from another moral state, an impressed and ignorant recruit. In the 18th century, most New England Calvinist churches had demanded of their full members baptism, and that often at a fairly advanced age when the subject would presumably be able to understand the meaning of the act, and a public testimony of conversion. In the 19th century, an innovative evangelical like Lyman Beecher might repudiate infant damnation, but he still insisted flatly, quote, "Baptism in infancy does not constitute adult membership in the visible church." Beecher deployed the Unitarian, quote, "attempt to confound the scriptural distinction between the regenerate and the unregenerate." So he's saying you can be baptized, but that doesn't prove anything. You also need to have a conversion experience when you're older and fully then accept coming into the state or the church. Prerequisites for church participation were squarely based on the conviction of innate depravity. Can you imagine someone like Joel Osteen telling me, you are innately depraved? No, Joel Osteen would say, you are a winner and God wants you to do well. You know, that's how they look at it now. Prerequisites for church participation were squarely based on the conviction of innate depravity. An expectation, I think they missed a syllable there, of the significance of maturity, or an expectation of the significance of maturity. Calvinists assumed that a struggle was to be fought by the Christian, which would require a certain amount of time, awareness, and skill. Now that makes more sense to me, doesn't it? God could pour his grace out on a mere child, the legendary conversion of the 4-year-old Phoebe Bartlett under the ministration of Jonathan Edwards was evidence of the fact, but he was unlikely to do so. It's more of a mature adult recognition of this is my nature and it needs to be overcome in this way, and this is how I mediate this through God and through his established institution, the Calvinist Church. And I had that come to me over, yes, as a flash, but that was the conclusion. It took years of thinking as well. I think I got that right. The Lord appeared to the 10 virgins because he so desired, not because they were waiting or not waiting for him, but woe to them whose lamps were not ready to shed light on his coming. At its best, Calvinism represented a complex set of values which fostered both achievement and humility. It demanded that its adherents be both children and adults. If one believed, however, with the liberals, that the soul came into the world already prepared, already converted, why delay or complicate admission into a church society which could only benefit by the presence of young Christians? Chanting like to praise, quote, the mild beauty of children, unquote. God would not, he believed, do anything, quote, repulsive and unamiable, unquote, as to damn them, as Calvinists had once held he did, or give them souls deserving of damnation. Horace Bushnell found no opinion, quote, more essentially monstrous than that which regards the Holy Spirit as having no agency in the immature souls of children who are growing up helpless and unconscious into the perils of their time. Bushnell did not deny the presence of evil in children, but he denied its dominance, and in doing so, he, like Channing, repudiated the essential presupposition of Calvinism, that God rightly demands something of man that is in some way impossible for man to do. The essential presupposition of Calvinism, that God rightly demands something of man that man cannot do, that is in some way impossible for man to do. In Bushnell's view, it is precisely when the individual is least amenable to and capable of conscious control, namely in childhood, that he or she is most assimilable to God. The great point is never to jar the child's sensibility, never to disturb the infant soul, which, like the needle of a compass, points unerringly and instinctively towards its maker. Children are to be encouraged, even imitated, not broken. Bushnell wanted early baptism and, like Sylvester Judd, he wished the baptized infants then to grow up Christians in the church, free to partake in communion, the standard test of adult membership, without any special profession. Piety was to be the result of habit, quote-unquote, not of effort. In this way, ministers could gain adherence without recourse to rivals, and very uncritical adherence at that. By a logical extension of the... So you see the self-interest would play in there. By a logical extension of the idea that God would accommodate himself to man and gain from it, adults were to please children for the profit of their churches and their souls. If Christ in the atonement acted on the unconscious, not the conscious, nature of men, ministers emulating him should logically address themselves to toddlers as well to grown-ups. They should they too should practice the techniques of maternal influence, quote-unquote, as formulated by women like Sigourney and Hale. The permeation of the Protestant Church by children, which Charles Follen saw in a vision one Sunday afternoon, was a statement of fact as well as a fantasized ideal. Liberal ministers increasingly wooed the souls of children under their pastoral care. Sylvester Judd, in his, quote, account, unquote, of his conversion to Unitarianism, explained that his intellectual perplexities were solved, or rather obviated, by a little girl's intuitive understanding of the Sermon on the Mount. Quote, "I should not be happy in heaven with God if I had a wicked heart," unquote, the child told Judd. He later wanted to make his Augusta, Maine parish into an extended family. He wrote to absent parishioners, especially the younger ones, as regularly and familiarly as if they were indeed part of his hearthside circle, always signing himself, quote, "your affectionate friend and pastor." He arranged special excursions and treats for children in his congregation. Judd was sincere, but he was setting and anticipating a trend. Love of children would become almost a professional requirement for the ministry. The provision later in the century for recreation rooms and secular amusements within the church was part of an effort to assimilate the church to the home and to the playground. The old Calvinist way of church induction presupposed a struggle for maturity that implied distancing from the mother and conflict with the father, and drew on an implicit and anticipatory analogy with Oedipal development. It assumed an expected pain, not the passive suffering of deprivation and martyrdom, but the active distress of assault and achievement. The most obvious metaphor for the newly opened church, as Bushnell and Judd conceived and tried to implement it, however, was that of a mother with her offspring, obviating their faults, smoothing their path, never letting them go. Domestic novelists, like the liberal ministers, reveled in the depiction of infantile piety, gently and easily coasting from the nursery into the safe harbor of the church. Susan Warner, in a fascinating late novel entitled Daisy Plains, 1885, which documents her own theological liberalization, shows two small girls, one white, the other a black servant, seeking church membership at the precocious age of 10. The father of the family, as always in Warner, has been a failure in every sense, but the mother has nurtured the children gently and incessantly in trust of Jesus, as well as in reliance on the Bible. Symbolically, they go to examination at the hands of a number of initially skeptical and hostile clergymen straight from mother's arms. After their simple and heartfelt answers to the tricky questions of their increasingly impressed interlocutors have demonstrated that little girls best understand the true theology, that true theology is but loving feeling. God is love, and that's basically all there is, all you need to know. They return to her proud embrace. Mother and church are one. Judd summed up the liberal idea when he described the conversion experience, ideally unconscious, as a return, a going home. So all the justice and the thinking and the rigor and the understanding God's ways and any kind of difficulty is all dissolving into just it's all how you feel, and it's all got to be just love. Liberal theology and literature increasingly downplayed the importance of pain and effort in the conversion process. In the liberal view, self-torment and self-denial were flawed not because they were bad in themselves, but because they could not really achieve their own goals. In Chapter 2, I talked about Eva Van Arsdale of Harriet Beecher Stowe's My Wife and I and We and Our Neighbors novels as the representative of the new impractical heroine increasingly popular in the fiction of mid-19th century America. Herself self-consciously childlike, not to say childish, Eva is an emblem of play, of leisure, of carefree gaiety, and a symbol of the increasing trust Stowe, in common with her culture, was putting on these qualities as instruments for the new Bushnellian kind of regeneration. Eva has nothing that she has to do. Her time is essentially recreational, and she passes her days by making friends and saving souls. Among her special flock is a colleague of her husband's, a sensitive and conscientious journalist called Bolton, who, because of a single bout of youthful intemperance, in adulthood still considers himself an alcoholic. In true Calvinist fashion, he judges himself, quote, lost, unquote, and unfit to marry the woman he loves, although she is spending her life pining for him. Eva firmly counters his opinion as, quote, morbid, unquote, and engineers his wedding to the girl of his dreams. A sense of sin and the stringent self-discipline it recommends represent false, if sincere, heroism. Bolton is not only happier, but more securely protected against his special failing, with a loving and beloved wife by his side. Again, the daughter of Eva's Irish cook, Mary, falls, through little fault of her own, into a life of prostitution. While their mother's denunciation and reproaches only upset and anger Maggie, while the stark costume and silent piety of the sisters of an Episcopalian order with whom she stays for a while but distance her, Eva's inexpensive finery, vivacious talkativeness, and affectionate ways lure her to Christ, the fallen woman lured to Christ. Eva poses no threats, awakens no fears, raises no defenses. She makes children of all who will play with her. Exponents of this new belief in play and of its importance in the conversion experience range from the religious hedonist to the theologian. Henry Ward Beecher, who asserted that to be a Christian was, quote, to be the happiest person in the world, unquote, told Yale students in 1872 that he, quote, studiously refused to entertain anxieties. Boy, that sounds modern, doesn't it? Stay positive. In the partial physicalization of respectable Protestantism, which was his most interesting achievement, I'm not quite sure what that means. Beecher, finding it best to put Calvin aside, redefined the elect as the healthy. So it goes from being morally upright or even rich to being physically healthy. He said and demonstrated that such would have, quote, an insatiable love of play, unquote. Beecher loved to watch fine horses. He collected old books and rare gems. Like other prophets of the mind cure movement, he sensed that mid and late 19th century Protestant America wanted religion to provide an antidote to work, as well as a spur to toil. He made religion an agent of personal liberation and fulfillment, a means of self-expression for l'homme sensuel, the sensual man, as well as for l'homme spirituel, the spiritual man. He revealed religion as a facilitator of leisure. Henry Ware Jr. had already tried to grapple with the problem of, quote, how to spend holy time, unquote, and had toyed fascinatedly with the possibilities of leisure implicit in the Unitarian emphasis on what Channing called the self-culture, quote unquote, self-culture. It took Beecher to say that spending time was itself holy. In Beecher's novel Norwood, Dr. Wentworth, a shrewd, humane, and aesthetic-minded physician, acts as his spokesman. At one point, Frank Edel, a broken-hearted, rejected lover, decides to turn from art to preaching to express his newfound conviction of life's tragic nature. When he consults Dr. Wentworth, however, the older man advises him to stick to painting. Dr. Wentworth points out that the Christian art preaches, and to a far larger congregation than the minister, but his real message for Edel is, dodge pain and self-denial. Pain and self-denial, in quotes. Beecher at this point is hovering tantalizingly between the idea that suffering is the easy way and the proposition that the easy way is the best one. Whatever his rationale, however, he wants his characters comfortable with themselves, self-acceptant, self-loving, and ample. Norwood is unmistakably a tedious book, composed of little action and much rambling and discursive talk. Beecher claims at the start that the pace of what he tellingly calls his leisurely narrative is intentional. He doesn't want his readers to devour the novel feverishly in a sitting as they might some highly colored romance, like Sir Walter Scott, say. He asks that they pursue it meditatively, reflectively, over a period of time, to taste, to relish, to savor. The novel is to be, in other words, a Beecherian religious experience, an exercise in consumer pleasure. Couple pages to go with this subtitle. Horace Bushnell, who brought to the rationalization of a post-Calvinist culture much of the intellectual responsibility and massiveness of the Calvinist theological tradition, published a study on, quote, work and play, in italics, in 1864. He begins by saying that his primary example and his motive for the investigation was the sight of, quote, his children and kitten playing down the floor together, unquote. The unconscious and spontaneous ways of children are his starting inspiration, although by no means his stopping point. He considers their play, quote, muscular, unquote. Goes on to a consideration of the, quote, hard struggle of adult work, unquote, which can peek into a realm of, quote, inspired liberty and spontaneous beauty, unquote. His conclusion is that, quote, we are to conceive that the highest and most complete state of man, that which his nature endeavors after and in which only it fulfills its sublime instinct, is the state of play. To say that a man labors is to say that he fails. And you see how protean this all is. It switches so easily. They just intellectualize something, they get bored with it, and they intellectualize something else. And who's to say they're right or wrong? It's just how persuasive they are to those around them. And if one school starts out hard, then soon enough, some of these high IQ, really driven Protestant types get bored with it, and they switch to something else. They'll switch, well, let's take the opposite side. Now, play is the highest thing. Bushnell here anticipates Beecher, who would explain, whoever thinks without thinking is in fact a genius. Bushnell admired Beecher's vitality, but found him theologically primitive, not to say barbaric, and his own thinking is much more complex than the Brooklyn preacher's. Both are advocating a post-romantic theory of organic development. Both call for the whole man. Both urge an intelligent opposition to the old Calvinist ethos, the resourcefulness of trust. To play is to offer testimony to the possibility of safety. Yet Beecher wants to obviate the necessity of work altogether. Bushnell is urging instead that its final end is mastery, harmony. Work, losing consciousness of itself as effort passes from determination into delight. He is in actuality engaged in a complex restatement for his modernizing society of the ancient Calvinist dilemma over the relation between the use of means and the passive awaiting of God's arbitrary grace. Bushnell hypothetically establishes a streamlined process by which neither is lost, but one becomes the other. It is a message of renewal and arrival, which is in no way ignores the necessity of the passage. He summed up his ideal of faith and hinted at all his differences with Beecher when he said, quote, abiding in Christ is to abide. It is not to bask. Nonetheless, his emphasis is on joy, not pain, play, not work, leisure, not effort. The unkindest cut history gives to human achievement is that the effects of our actions are often so much simpler than the intentions behind them. Different as their aims were, Bushnell and Beecher finally moved America in similar directions. Bushnell habitually delivered sermons whose length and argumentative density humiliated his little daughter. Well aware of the predilections of his Hartford congregation, he continued to publish even denser treatises, although his sermons sold better. Nonetheless, his most fascinating and most successful attempt as a religious thinker was his effort to introduce leisure as an element into theological thought. He once said that, quote, if I had my life to lead over again, there is one thing I would not do. I would not push. And like Beecher, although at an incomparably more profound level, he tried to teach theology the art of relaxation. This is Bushnell. Having undergone a prolonged period of religious anxiety and uncertainty in early manhood, he later used to advise others involved in a similar ordeal. Block quote here. Never be in a hurry to believe. Never try to conquer doubts about time or against time. Time is one of the grand elements in thought, as truly in motion. If you cannot open a doubt today, keep it till tomorrow. Do not be afraid to keep it whole years. So let it gestate and mature. In his most difficult theological work, he urges his readers to take it easy. a bit like a guide leading a group of amateurs on an arduous expedition. He promises his readers that there is, quote, nothing too abstruse or difficult in what he asks them to understand. They are proceeding, quote, along open ranges of thought, rapidly bearing a, quote, a considerable continent already behind us. They can stretch, they can breathe. Territorial imagery occurs as naturally in Bushnell's prose as physical metaphors appear in Beecher's more heated periods. Bushnell believed that forgiveness is man's deepest need and his highest achievement. The forgiveness he has in mind is like that which Stowe's Eva Van Arsdale urges on Bolton in My Wife and I, self-forgiveness. Man's conversion experience is no longer an acceptance of God so much as an acceptance of himself, and Bushnell understands this as a function of happiness, of nurture, and of process. Ministers of an older day like Jonathan Edwards, or even latter-day revivalists like Charles Grandison Finney and Lyman Beecher, stress the inexorable press, the immediate need of conversion. The crisis was now, the decision was now, time was running out, which was to be your destination, heaven or hell, you could die at any moment. Tomorrow you may wake up, Edwards intoned in his correct, precise voice, his eye fixed habitually and calmly on the back of the room. In hell. Tomorrow you may wake up in hell. Wouldn't it be fun to preach to people like that? No one dares nowadays, and there's no interest in hearing it. Tomorrow you may wake up in hell. Bushnell, like Henry Ward Beecher, is arguing that time is on your side. Relax, take it easy. Time is no longer God's days and years, marshaled toward the relentless revelation of the divine will, but man's. Moments running freely into space, like a stream pooling into a lake. Expansion, cultivation, flow is the mortal task, not contraction, discipline, and strain. Nathaniel Emmons, a theological innovator, despite, he claimed because of, the strictness of his creed, was under genuine pressure as he dryly pursued truth. Thinking for him was a matter of finding clues to a vast design planned by someone else. Ratiocination was a string leading in and out of the divine labyrinth. Thinking for the much less scholarly, although more brilliant, Bushnell was to be inspiration, play, creativity. Austin Phelps, perceptive as always, understood that for Bushnell, quote, work was discovery. He was a, quote, a seer, not a reasoner, unquote, and he could ignore predecessors with a fine disdain. Self-expression for Henry Ward Beecher had become posture, gesture. For Horace Bushnell, it was insight, vision, but both posited as the goal of religious experience and development. Assimilation, ease. In downplaying the Calvinist overemphasis on effort with its reification of pain, Beecher and Bushnell tended also to downplay the inevitable role agony plays in human experience. Trust is not a good in itself. It must take account of obstacles and define its objects. Both Beecher and Bushnell helped to create the rationale for Eva Van Arsdale and her calculated oblivion, anticipatory of the consumer's amnesia. So that ends that particular subtitle. Fascinating stuff, I think, and it's how it evolved into society got a little richer, it had a little more time, and it began to prefer and found the voices for a type of theology that was much more emphasis on play and leisure and time and love and mercy than on the strictness and contraction of limited goods and more intense intellectualization. Although they still, by legacy, are very intellectual people, and they're justifying what they do. But we move along, anyway. So we're up to page 168 now, out of about 400 or so. Anyway, thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon.